produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Free Culture Radio, decolonizing coca. The nations of Colombia and Bolivia held an event at the UN in New York on November 7th to challenge the negative connotation attributed to the coca plant. The event was entitled Beyond Declassification, Detoxifying Narratives Around the Coca Leaf. One of the speakers was Wade Davis, Ph.D. Dr. Davis is a professor of anthropology and the BC Leadership Chair in Cultures and Ecosystems at Risk at the University of British Columbia.
So right, but let's just begin. Let me take you into the northwest Amazon of Colombia, into the homeland of the Barasana on the Rio Piraparana. Now it's nighttime. We've entered a moloca. And at the end of the moloca, you hear the children and the mothers beginning to go to bed. And in the front of the moloca, the men gather as they do every night. And you hear the slow toasting of the coca that was harvested that afternoon. And beside you, a young man flares a pile of yaruma leaves. The flames rush above your head and come back down as white ash. The ash and the leaves are put into a mortar and pestle and slowly pounded as the men gather in a circle and discuss the day. And quietly they take the mambe. A gentle, subtle sense of well-being comes over them. And they discuss the ancestors, the Iowa, the heroes who brought order to the world. And this is the role that mambe plays throughout the Amazon of Colombia. Healthy for the people. My professor, the legendary explorer Richard Evans Schultes, proudly used mambe every day in the 13 years he was in the Amazon. In fact, he once brought out a lata of mambe at a society party in Bogota and told anyone who would listen that the proper species of yaruma to use for the ash was one and not the other. And he, of course, had the good stuff. Now, on October 31st, 2020, WPV1 Action News in Philadelphia led its evening report with a sensational account of a drug bust at Philadelphia International Airport. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents had seized more than 12 pounds of what they called green cocaine, along with a mysterious brown substance that had tested positive for nicotine. The mambe had tested positive for cocaine, but according to the authorities, the green hue was just a way of camouflaging the drug, which through a chemical process using gasoline, ammonia, and other chemicals could be turned white. The implication being that this green cocaine was just that, cocaine tinged by another color. This seizure, reported Casey Durst, the head of Baltimore's field office, perfectly illustrates how Customs and Border Protection officers use keen instinct and professional scientific analysis to interpret dangerous drugs being smuggled into our communities. In Cincinnati, Port Director Richard Gillespie praised those who were singularly responsible, as he put it, for keeping this dangerous green powder out of our neighborhoods. Unfortunately, beneath the righteous pose was a farce worthy of Molière. The source of the nicotine in the bust I knew well. It was ambil, an addictive, a traditional paste full of tobacco, and an addictive drug that, if used through the vehicle of smoking, causes the death of almost 500,000 Americans each year. Tobacco being legal, that substance was of no concern to the customs agents. The green powder, of course, was not cocaine, it was mambe. As early as 1957, my professor had reported its use as a mild stimulant and essential component of the nutritional regime of the peoples of the Northwest Amazon. Daily consumption more than satisfied the daily requirements for calcium, iron, phosphorus, vitamin A, and riboflavin. prepared from an Amazonian variety of coca with notably low concentrations of the alkaloid, less than 0.5% dry weight, mambe was food as much as stimulant, as innocuous as a cup of coffee and far better for the health. Now, those same news reports said that the green cocaine had been sent to labs in Savannah and Newark for analysis. Not reported were the actual results of the assays, trivial amounts of cocaine analogous to the amount of caffeine you might find in a coffee bean. Had anyone tried to snort the powder, they would have simply plugged their nostrils most unpleasantly with a substance the consistency of talcum powder. Coca mambe is always consumed orally. And to suggest that smugglers might have imported mambe to extract cocaine, even assuming it could be done with all the ash in the preparation, makes about as much sense as saying that somebody would import Dom Perignon to extract ethyl alcohol. Like champagne, mambe is a specialized item made by highly trained individuals on a small scale, a labor-intensive process that yields a highly valued and unique natural product. Drug cartels that have successfully shipped cocaine into America by the ton for 50 years are not going to waste their time with it. What in fact transpired in Philadelphia was a drug bust on par with Elliot Ness. I don't know if you know, Elliot Ness was an old FBI hero, seizing a truckload of potatoes for vodka and taking it all down as if in violation of the Volstead Act. Now, it's one thing to note with regret that after 50 years of a war on drugs, there are more people in more places using worse drugs than ever before. It's quite another to acknowledge that having spent billions of dollars a year, $1 trillion altogether on this misguided crusade, our American frontline defenders still do not know the difference between a pure alkaloid first extracted in 1859 and coca, a benign and nutritious plant revered today by millions of indigenous people and long celebrated by the ancient civilizations of South America as a divine leaf of immortality. But you know, new drugs always cause problems. The French Revolution was caused by caffeine. Until the arrival of coffee, tea, and chocolate in Europe, you couldn't drink the water if you didn't want to get cholera. Suddenly, the tea had to be boiled, took care of the pathogens. And because these were valued commodities, they were sold in coffee houses. It became centers of intrigue. And instead of being in your local tavern or bar with your brow and your beer, you were wired on caffeine and you couldn't shut up. And you suddenly, you know, Versailles is a little bit bigger than my place. The actual mob that stormed the Bastille left from Voltaire's favorite coffee house, the Café de Feuilly. And of course, those in charge naturally didn't like this, and they tried to prohibit coffee. And in fact, as late as 1777, Frederick the Great in Germany tried to get his people back onto beer because it made for a more docile citizenry. But the problem is, by that point, it was too late. One could harvest a field with tumblers of beer, but you couldn't work a machine tool. And so coffee and tea became part of the engine of the Industrial Revolution. And because of that, the plant was culturally redefined. Now, caffeine's a dangerous drug. Rats become addicted to caffeine. Rats that are addicted to caffeine will tear their flesh apart to get more. But that didn't lead us to prohibit coffee. We socialized coffee. We created the coffee break, which was nothing more or less than a regular moment to take another dose of the drug. And as a result, today there is no black market in caffeine. There is no cartel taking advantage of our affection for that drug. Coffee has been socialized and generating huge amounts of revenue for those countries lucky enough to grow it. Now, the first drug ever extracted from a plant was morphine. The second was cocaine. And it remains to this day our most powerful topical anesthetic, an illustration of the adage that there's no such thing as good and bad drugs, just good and bad ways of using drugs. The Corsican Mariani, of course, came down famously on the side of a good use, and his then Mariani Bordeaux wine and cocaine and coca leaves became a hit. In fact, he turned on 4 U.S. presidents, 4 kings, 2 popes, 3 princes, 1 Russian czar, a shah, and the grand rabbi of France to coca. And as the most popular prescribed medicine in the world, it had imitators, and that gave rise to Coca-Cola. And to this day, Coca-Cola is the only legal importer of coca in the United States. It brings in 150 tons every year from Anaco in Trujillo. And this, of course, although the company doesn't advertise it, is what makes Coca-Cola the real thing. But by the late 19th century, cocaine was in everything. It was seen as a panacea, but then it became clear that it was not. And overnight, cocaine went from being heralded to being denigrated as the dangerous drug that it, in fact, can be. And as the laws increasingly circumscribed the use of the drug, it was condemned as a narcotic, which it is not. And as they became, people came to feel that cocaine and morphine were equally dangerous, coca became associated with opium. And the public was led to believe that the ruinous effects of habitual opium use would befall those who chewed coca leaves. And thus, a mild stimulant that had been used for 8,000 years before Europeans discovered cocaine came to be viewed as an addictive drug. But coca is not cocaine. And to equate the leaf with the raw alkaloid is as misguided as confusing the delicious flesh of a peach with the hydrogen cyanide found in every peach pit. And yet, for nearly a century, that has been precisely the legal and political position of nations and international organizations throughout the world. The United States government, in particular, has long demonized the plant. And just to the point that the ambassador made, the efforts to eradicate the traditional fields began over 50 years before there was a cocaine problem. The real issue was not cocaine, but the cultural identity and survival of those who traditionally used the plant. The call for eradication came from officials and physicians, particularly in Lima, but both Peruvian and American, whose concern for the well-being of Andean peoples was matched in its intensity only by their ignorance of Andean life.
You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. We've been listening to a presentation by Professor Wade Davis, PhD, an anthropologist and researcher at the University of British Columbia, at an event entitled Beyond Declassification, Detoxifying Narratives Around the Coca Leaf. Let's hear more.
Now, in the wake of the conquest, as the ambassador said, the Spanish lay waste to everything. And of course, they naturally banned coca as being the essence of the devil. But that didn't really work for them because they needed coca to run the mines. And so in 1572, Toledo reversed that fiat. Coca became commercialized in the colony as never before. And in fact, the mission of the Christian Church in Peru for 3 centuries was made possible by a plant that the clergy had initially condemned as the weed of the devil. And this is where it gets interesting, to pay attention to the early chroniclers, all of whom who heralded this plant. Garcilaso de la Vega said, "The leaf satisfies the hunger, gives new strength to the weary, makes the unhappy forget their sorrows." Pedro Cieza de Leon, "When I asked some of these Indians why they carried these leaves, they replied it prevents them from feeling hungry and gives them great vigor and strength." Throughout the post-conquest era, praise for the leaves was extraordinary. The Swiss naturalist Johann Jakob de Schudi, he spent 5 years in the Andes, and he found individual people who consume no less than 2,700 pounds of leaves in a lifetime, and not only was the plant innocuous, it was conducive to health. In Europe, this man, Sir Robert Christensen, president of the British Medical Association, decided to put coca to a test as he and 10 students set out to walk 30 miles across Scotland and climb a vast mountain. And he wrote, "On arrival home before dinner, I felt neither hunger nor thirst after complete absence from food. This is a miracle plant." And At that time, this man was 78 years old. And these kinds of qualities are recited time and again by independent, non-judgmental observers throughout the 19th century. J.T. Lloyd, who is in Popayan in 1913, after eating a simple breakfast, it would start with a heavy packs weighing 75 to more than 100 pounds. All day long, they traveled. On these trips, they neither rested. They found blah, blah, blah. He said, all I can explain is they had the beautiful leaf in their mouths, and that's how they could do it. Now, the ultimate praise came from this remarkable man, Henry Mortimer, who wrote the classic History of Coca in 1901. And there's a very funny anecdote. The International Lacrosse Championship in Toronto, my country, in 1877. One team are these fat clerks from the business section of town. The other team are these robust lumberjacks from the mountains and the forests of Canada. The lumberjacks should win, but the clerks won because the heat exhausted everybody, but the clerks were chewing coca. And that's how, in 1877, the fat clerks won the International Lacrosse Championship. And what's interesting about Mortimer, this is what's really interesting. Mortimer acknowledged coca as a panacea. He noted its virtues as medicine, tonic, and food. But what really impressed him was the subtlety of its action. It was a stimulant, to be sure, but also not a stimulant, or at least unlike anything ever seen by science. It's remarkable, another physician wrote, that coca, nothing can rival its sustaining power, no other at the same time has so little effect. The chewing of coca gives no especial sensation. In fact, the only result seems to be a negative one, an absence of tiredness and the desire for, let's see, we might be having, where's the, and so this is the quality of coca. It's an, just, let's see, podemos botar, you know? It's the subtlety of action. Now, the difference between coca and cocaine, the Peruvian anthropologist Enrique Meyer once quipped, is the difference between traveling by donkey and jet plane. It was a clever line, but one that misses an essential point. The actions of coca and cocaine are not comparable. Cocaine assaults the senses. Those who use the traditional leaves show no preference for varieties with high concentrations of the alkaloid. They always prefer those plants with the most subtle effect, the essential oils, the proteins. Mambe, for example, is made from coca with the lowest concentration. And what's more, the cultures of cocaine and coca consumption could not be more distinct. What draws people to cocaine is the exotic decadence, the mystique of a rich man's drug. The ritual of a handful of the select few sneaking into the corner of a room to snort grains of something that could be just about any way, anything these days. A lingering legacy of the cocaine culture of the 1980s is an epidemic of hepatitis C contracted by those who in their youth somehow found it glamorous to stick up their nose a $100 banknote damp with the snot of a stranger. Coca, of course, by contrast, is less a high than a meditation. Consumed in the Amazon as mambe, throughout the Andes, it is, of course, consumed as the ambassador suggested, as whole leaves. And to absorb the small amount of the alkaloid, one must change the alkalinity of the mouth, and that is why people use ash in the Amazon, yipta, tocra, and various other substances throughout the range. The Kogi in the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta of Colombia prefer seashells, which they gather at the end of long ritual pilgrimages to the sea. And for the Mamos of the Kogi in Arawako, the chewing of hayo is the most profound expression of culture. Their spiritual ideal would be to refrain from sex and eating and sleeping and simply taste the leaves and chant the names of the ancestors. At night they rest, in the morning, hayo grants the dawn. Every adult man consumes roughly a pound of leaves, beginning at marriage and continuing until his final breath. in the mountains of the southern Andes in Peru and Bolivia, distance is measured not in miles or kilometers, but in cocadas, the length of time that a traveler is sustained by a single chew of leaves. When men and women meet on the trail, they pause to exchange quintus of coca, three perfect leaves arranged as a cross. They then turn to face the nearest apu, or sacred protective mountain, and with eyes lifted to the summit, they bring the leaves to the mouth and blow softly, a ritual invocation that sends the essence of the plants back to the earth, the community, the sacred places, the souls of the ancestors. The exchange of leaves is a social gesture, a way of acknowledging a human connection. But the blowing of the puke is an act of spiritual reciprocity, for in giving selflessly to the earth, the individual ensures that in time the energy of the coca will be returned full circle, as just as surely as rain falling on a field is reborn as a cloud. And the subtlety of gesture is itself a prayer for the survival of the entire Andean world. So the etiquette of Jalpai, the totality of using coca in the Andes, the exchange and salutations, the way you put leaves in the mouth, the reverence and respect, that defines what it means to be Runakuna, a child of Pachamama. You cannot function as a social being unless you partake in the ritual, and you must do it properly. Nothing offends people more than gringos putting leaves in their mouths like horses eating hay. And whether or not the coca is taken with a friend or a stranger, alone or together, to Jalpai is to transcend self and become part of the social, moral, and spiritual nexus that in the Andes gives meaning to life. Coca alone allows direct communication with the divine. Thus, in the Andes, to be without coca is a form of social and spiritual death, an excommunication from existence itself. So efforts to deny the people of the Andes access to leaves, to eradicate the traditional fields, are not analogous to outlawing, for example, beer in Germany or coffee in the Middle East or betel chewing in India. They become policies of cultural genocide. Now, the war on drugs, just to bring this to a close, began when Nixon in 1972 wanted to isolate his voting bloc and demonize his opponents. He cared nothing about drug use and consumption. At that time, there was no illicit problem with cocaine. But today, 50 years on, there's more cocaine being produced and trafficked than ever before. Thanks to the war on drugs, an actual war killed 400,000 Colombian people, 7 million internally displaced, 5 million forced to flee their country. How would Americans feel if Canada had policies of drug consumption, practices of drug consumption, and policies that prohibited the drug, facilitating the black trade, but enforcement that did nothing to curtail that trade, such that 85 million Americans were forced to leave their homes? But that is indeed what happened in Colombia. And even were the complete removal of coca possible, it's not necessarily it would be for the best. Coca grows in the most remote regions of Colombia. There are 230,000 Colombian campesino families who depend on coca cultivation for their well-being and the well-being of their children. Efforts to substitute crops are delusional. Coca gives three crops a year, highly commercially valuable, easy to transport in a nation with limited infrastructure in the hinterland. And indeed, efforts to eradicate the crops from the air are also doomed to fail. And why are we stuck? I'll tell you. In 1975, when I came back to America, after 2 years of studying coca in the field, there was a job offer at the USDA that I was asked to apply for, but told if I tried it, accepted the job, I'd be killed by my friend. And I went out to the USDA and met this official who was clearly DEA, not USDA, And all he had concluded from our 2 years of research, where we had shown that coca was a vital part of the cultural aspirations, that it was a highly nutritious plant, all he concluded was that I was good at finding cocales. And my job offer was to go back into Bolivia and Colombia and Peru, go into the fields and secure the biological pests that predated on coca, bring them back so they could be genetically manipulated and reintroduced into Latin America. I realized that I was looking at the other half of the drug cartel. They were the same. The energy was the same as the people that I had known in Medellin in 1973. And this is why this war on drugs persists and the violation of those who are suffering the most because of it, particularly the Colombians. And surely it's time to find another way. It's not just that coca is not cocaine, it's that this war on drugs has denied the world the benefits of Latin America's greatest gift to the world. If I told you objectively that there was a substance, not coffee, not tea, but making it like this, but something you could gently take in the morning, everybody suffers from existential malaise. You haven't done your homework. Your kids haven't done their homework. You could get up in your morning and suddenly you took this totally benign, you got a little bit of a light step in your foot, certain sense of well-being, but without any sense of having anything in you, you were suddenly able to focus 8 hours, concentrate on your work, be a little bit more creative, go home, be with your family, and do it again the next day. Wouldn't that be attractive? I think so. And the point is that coca isn't just not cocaine. Coca is a plant with so much economic benefit that properly marketed, it could literally rival coffee. And in that sense, we could give work to all, legitimate work to all those growing it, and at the same time, generate for Colombia in particular, the tax revenues to pay the cost of peace, having drained our treasury for 50 years to pay for a war that would not have lasted one day without the sordid profits of prohibition. It's really time that we liberate this plant. And this is what's so beautiful about the ambassadors being here. Colombia and Bolivia at last coming together to reclaim this beautiful plant, which is not a drug. It is, as the Inca always said it to be, a sacred plant, the divine leaf of immortality. Thank you.
That was Wade Davis, PhD, a professor of anthropology and the BC Leadership Chair in Cultures and Ecosystems at Risk at the University of British Columbia, speaking at an event entitled Beyond Declassification, Detoxifying Narratives Around the Coca Leaf, that was held at the United Nations in New York on November 7th. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!